documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
So just south of the Great Lakes capital city, suffering the aftermath of Snowmageddon and broadcasting live from FEMA Region 5 in the wet and frosty swamplands of reinvented Michigan, this is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here for the next 3 hours. Nice to have you with us as we once again document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy. Today's the 27th of February, 2016. And it's good to have you with us once again, ladies and gentlemen, as we have been dumped on this past week, just a few days ago, a couple of days ago, actually, with a massive, I don't know what else to call it, but snowpocalypse, ladies and gentlemen. Just as we had some hints of spring here, had relatively mild weather, suddenly it took a turn for the worst, and I felt for everybody that had to be out on the roads. Luckily, normally I get up caught up in that myself. It just happened to fall on a day where I didn't really have to go anywhere. And so after I gathered my family, managed to convince them to leave wherever they had to be early, I was very happy that everybody here anyway didn't have to be out in it. But I was praying for all the folks that did. And then I think it's supposed to be up to 50 again this weekend. So go figure. This is Michigan, where if you don't like the weather, wait about 5 minutes and it probably will change on you. Anyway, there's a lot going on today, and I shouldn't have opened my big mouth last week about the mass shooting events, the high-profile shootings, because we've had no shortage of those this past week. And it seems like, I don't know, you know, the funny thing about this shooting thing is it seems to me like we have shootings all the time in America, ladies and gentlemen. We have shootings, you know, there's violent acts that take place every day, no matter where you go, whether it's a shooting, whether it's a stabbing, whether it's violent crime. I think the difference here today is we have mass media paying attention to it. Mass media to call your attention to the various shooting events that take place, so it makes it seem like they're more prominent than they really are. And again, we have to focus on the issue of whether, you know, what is the role of the psychotropic drugs in all of these things? Why are people going crazy? Why are people going off the deep end? Everybody needs to be paying attention to the reality that we have a massively drugged up population. We have never, I don't think, in the history of humanity had so many people on mind-altering drugs. And we're not just talking psychotropics here. We're talking side effects of other medications which cause various different types of, psychosis, for lack of a better way of saying it. Anyway, we'll get to the shooting stuff as time progresses. Right now, I want to focus on the issue of this Brexit. The British government and David Cameron over there, the Prime Minister, has called for a June referendum. Now, my understanding, of course, you know, David Cameron is not exactly a sovereignty type of person. He's very much the globalist. Very much worked very closely with the Bush administration when the Bush administration was in office here. And he had, in the aftermath of 9/11, a speech where he talked about, let us reorder this world. Let us reorder this world and use science to provide prosperity for all. And what is he talking about when he talks about science? He's talking about technocracy, ladies and gentlemen. This whole idea where the new carbon currency is going to be the energy tax, it's going to be the energy currency that's going to drive the entire world economy. Okay, we're talking about a new monetary unit, which will be a world unit, ultimately, and replace the dollar, replace all the world units. This is what they are struggling to try to create today. So David Cameron is a total globalist, and he is completely and totally all in on a global economy and a global currency, a global tax, global. So why is he proposing this referendum? Because predominantly because he's been pressured into it. And at least that's what I'm hearing and seeing. And they're counting on the fact that it'll fail. However, and to be fair, it was a long shot back a while. But now there's a lot of very upset people in Britain. The refugee crisis has created some problems among the European countries. And it seems like maybe the British people are getting fed up with dealing with the European Union. They're getting fed up with losing control over their sovereignty, as are other European countries. We see from Sky News, Boris Johnson, who is the mayor of London, he's now backing the campaign to leave the European Union. London mayor says he did not want to go against David Cameron, but after a great deal of heartache, he felt he had no choice. They say Boris Johnson has just revealed he will campaign for Britain to leave the European Union in a major blow to the Prime Minister. The decision by the London mayor ends months of speculation and represents a huge coup for the Leave campaign, given his broad appeal among voters. Mr. Johnson informed the Prime Minister by text just 9 minutes before making his statement. While he told reporters David Cameron had done, quote, fantastically well in the deal he reached with Brussels, he added no one could drastically claim that this is a fundamental reform of the European Union. So apparently David Cameron was over there trying to negotiate or renegotiate the terms of Britain's participation in the European Union and had some sort of quote-unquote deal, which he is pushing now in the British Parliament. Anyway, they say Mr. Johnson said the last thing I wanted to do was go against David Cameron or the government, but after a great deal of heartache, I don't think there's anything else I can do. I will be advocating vote leave because I want a better deal for the people of this country to save them money and to take back control. So I don't know how far this referendum is going to go, ladies and gentlemen. I have real doubts, and I've expressed them often on this show, about our election systems here in the United States, being that they are highly susceptible to fraud. And in fact, I'm thinking national elections are highly rigged. Another reason why they shouldn't really garner too much attention, because quite honestly, they fixed the vote. And Ireland just tried to leave the European Union not too long ago. And the people were propagandized, they were scared, and was the vote valid there? Who knows? But the point is that this indicates what a mess Europe is, what an absolute disaster globalism is. So why would we want to try it here in the West? That's my point. And the thing is that we are seeing the present administration doing just that. And again, we see one administration here domestically pick up where the other one leaves off. Bush was pushing the North American Union. Obama has continued the same policies. They're just not being continued very overtly. It's went black. It's went dark. Certain people in the alternative media have said, oh, well, it's all been disbanded now. Nothing to see here. But that's not true. They changed the names. They changed the strategies. But behind the scenes, the mergings of the country go forward. Here we see from TruePublica, Tories unleash military leaders, Russian invasion, ISIS, threats from U.S., and NATO in fear campaign. See, what they're doing here is they're trying their best to propagandize, to scare, to do whatever they can to get the British people to be against their own sovereignty, against their own country, to vote themselves into a global government enslavement campaign, into a region where they lose control over their own government. I mean, not that they really have a whole lot of control over the British government anyway, but I mean, when the government that's closest to you, ladies and gentlemen, you have more control of than a government that's far, far away. you might have some influence over your government if it's closer to you. But the farther away your government is from you, the larger the block that you're, that the government, and I hate to use the word your government, but for lack of a better way of saying it, I mean, a bigger block, a bigger governing entity is farthest away from the voice of the people. Brussels, Belgium does not have to listen to the people of Britain. At the very least, the British Parliament has to at least pretend that they are. So, they say, originally Britain signed up to the European Economic Community, or EEC, via a referendum in 1975. For the purposes of enhancing trade, it was in essence a trade deal. Everybody should listen to this very carefully.
Govern America.
Wrong button, sorry. That's what I meant to do. Here's the thing, folks. This is what you need to be paying attention to. When you are focused. Okay, they said this is a trade. It started as a trade deal. What do we have going on here? We have the North American Free Trade Agreement, a trade deal, which they say will not interfere with sovereignty, which they say will not undermine and drop U.S. borders between Canada and Mexico. Okay, it was a trade deal that this European Economic Community, EEC, was a referendum in 1975. I'm sure they promised the world as far as economy, economic benefits. Oh, this is going to be so wonderful for Britain. Well, if it's so wonderful for them, why is there a referendum now to get out of it? Why are people increasingly supporting backing out of it? Some polls have it as a majority of voters, potential voters, as being wanting. Over 50% want out. Why? If it's so wonderful for them. But see, it was sold. It started. It began as the European Economic Community. Hey, that sounds an awful lot like a North American community, doesn't it? Building a North American community. You see, here's the thing, folks. They do the same thing over and over and over and over again. Same thing. Counting on the fact that you folks either aren't going to know, aren't going to pay attention, or you're going to forget. 1975 was a long time ago. Anyway, they say it was created, this European Economic Community was created for enhancing trade. It was, in essence, a trade deal, or at least that was how it was sold to the British people. And what about this Trans-Pacific Partnerships? Folks, that's another trade deal. Is that going to create a community? Is that going to create a new bloc? Well, if they get it through, it will. What about the U.S.-European trade deal, what they call TAFTA? Another situation, even as the European Union is going up in smoke, we're talking about another secret trade deal being negotiated by multinational corporations where the people are being kept in the dark about it, and this is being negotiated right now with the European Union. They say what the unsuspecting people of Britain were not aware of was that in reality the origins of the European Union was devised by the USA back in the 1950s that saw the continent more as an opportunity of a puppet-run superstate filled with attendant yes-men for trade and the manipulation of strategic global markets and, just as importantly, a defensive buffer zone against its new foe, the Reds from Russia. Okay, now they note then, think TTIP, Ukraine, and the ever-expanding NATO alliance. In recent years, the grandiose rhetoric of David Cameron's speeches, acting more as a public relations ambassador to corporations than for his own citizens, has dwindled in the face of more important issues to the people, namely immigration and the refugee crisis. And for all of Cameron's bragging of a New Deal, the European Union is not about to change the universal treaties to accommodate Britain in some sort of a two-tier system. The EU's impartial heart is not planted in democracy, and it never will be. Anything Cameron has negotiated are nothing but mere words, listeners, to the overridden at will, to be overridden at will, by an authoritarian judiciary in Brussels at a later date when convenient. You see, that's the thing. They do what they want in Brussels. And if you agree to it, you agree to lose your sovereignty. You go along. Like the Scottish referendum, Cameron is resorting to a fear-mongering campaign out of desperation. It will include politicians, corporations, business leaders, celebrities, and even the new menace threatening, they say, our democracy, the military. Cameron's team has already planned and is now executing a campaign of fear far greater than the Scottish referendum, but will ensure it won't emanate from number 10, which is where they're, it's like they're Washington, D.C., basically. It's where the parliament, or not the parliament, but the prime minister operates out of. To ensure his image is not tarnished as the noble champion of Britain. America is worried that its 1950s plan for a united Europe to economically conquer will fall apart, and they have every intention of influencing British voters to do what they call the right thing in America's interest. Many stories will emanate from the international bully boy. The Obama administration has already weighed in. It has threatened to exclude Britain from trade deals and influential global decisions. So worried is America that the Obama administration is threatening the UK by dissolving its so-called special relationship with Britain. Damon Wilson, former European Affairs Director at the National Security Council under George Bush, told senators last month in a meeting, quote, "The United Kingdom may turn its back on the European Union this year, depriving us, the United States, of a critical voice in shaping not only EU policy, but the future of Europe. Such a decision by London may prompt Scotland to dissolve the United Kingdom, ending this special relationship as we know it. These moves could fuel separatist efforts in Catalonia and Wallonia while opening the prospect of other states leaving the Union. They're really pushing the propaganda machine in a major way, ladies and gentlemen. BBC says Brexit will make it harder for UK to fight terrorism. They say fighting crime and terrorism in the UK would be more costly and much less effective if the country leaves the European Union, the director of the EU's police agency Europol has told BBC. That was from the BBC, but the fear campaign has gone dark as the Telegraph reports British military leaders to warn against a Brexit. They say in a dangerous escalation in the demise of democracy in Britain, Downing Street is organizing a letter from military leaders warning voters not to leave the EU at a time of Russian aggression and rising Islamic extremism. The Telegraph report continues, quote, "More than a dozen of the country's most senior military leaders will argue that Britain should vote to stay in the European Union because of its importance to national security. The letter is likely to be published this week and comes as both David Cameron and Michael Fallon put Britain's national security at the heart of their arguments for remaining in the European Union. However, it is likely to lead to accusations from Eurosceptic campaigners that the Prime Minister is resorting to Project Fear to make the case for staying in the European Union." So anyway, it goes on from there. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, they're going to do whatever they can to tilt this vote to the point where they scare the people into literally voting themselves into more global enslavement. That's what they did in Ireland when the Irish vote came down. It was very exciting to see the Irish referendum take place, but to see it defeated, a very, very big blow to the people of Ireland. Yeah, it would have been painful. But how painful is it now for the people of Ireland? They're still suffering. Wolf Street says, referendums are tricky in the EU. This time around, a referendum will be held in the UK, the EU's second biggest net provider of funds, and most importantly, not a member of the single currency. The vote, in all likelihood, represents the biggest political decision British voters will make in their lifetime. The fear on both sides of the English Channel is palpable. Brexit panic has sent the pound sterling spiraling to 2009 lows against the dollar. It didn't take long for the UK's business elite to begin sounding the alarms. 200 CEOs, listeners, chairmen and chairwomen, representing 1.2 million employees and 33 FTSE 100 firms, put their names to a letter warning that British business needs unrestricted access to the European market of 500 million people in order to continue to grow, invest, and create jobs, unquote. Or else. The fear-mongering has only just begun. In the coming months, they say all manner of doom and gloom scenarios will be paraded to cajole British voters into voting the right way. And what is the right way? Yeah, you guessed it. Stay. Almost all of Britain's elite institutions, including the two main political parties and most importantly the City of London Corporation, want Britain to remain in the EU. But the genie is already out of the bottle. Now it's just a question of waiting to see how the popular mood in Britain evolves over the next 5 months of intense electioneering. By this stage in proceedings, Europe facing rising political divisions and instabilities, economic upheaval, a refugee crisis, and possibly even a full-blown banking meltdown, listeners, the only emotion the EU has left to play on is fear. Now, it's kind of interesting. We have a number of different reports here. There's a network out of Britain called Channel 4. And this is some of what they had to say, including sound bites from the Prime Minister.
Back from across the channel to defend his deal, the Prime Minister came to Parliament, seven men down. Six ministers who sit in the cabinet and one MP who'd like to chair it. Boris Johnson's decision to back the Leave campaign unnerved some of the Prime Minister's supporters and fired up critics in his own party.
Why is it that people question your motives?
There's always going to be a lot of bickering and moaning.
Boris Johnson in the past has raised the idea that a vote to leave in June would not mean Britain leaving the EU straight away, but would trigger another, better negotiation, which saw EU countries cave in to British demands. David Cameron told MPs that was fantasy.
Having a second renegotiation followed by a second referendum is not on the ballot paper. And for a Prime Minister to ignore the express will of the British people to leave the EU would not just be wrong, it would be undemocratic. Yeah. On the diplomacy, the idea that other European countries would be ready to start a second negotiation is for the birds. Many are under pressure for what they have already agreed. Sadly, Mr. Speaker, I have known a number of couples who've begun divorce proceedings, but I do not know of any who've begun divorce proceedings in order to renew their marriage vows.
Most of the laughter and cheers throughout his address came from the Labour benches. His own were pretty quiet. He ended with a thinly veiled swipe at Boris Johnson's ambition to have his job.
I am not standing for re-election. I have no other agenda. I have no other agenda than what is best for our country. I'm standing here telling you what I think. My responsibility as Prime Minister is to speak plainly about what I believe is right for our country. And that is what I will do every day for the next 4 months. And I commend this statement to the House.
Mr. Boris Johnson!
As Boris Johnson rose, he was cheered by some fellow Brexit supporters, dismissed by one Remain MP sitting behind him, heckled by another.
Can I ask my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, to explain to the House and to the country in exactly what way this deal returns sovereignty over any field of lawmaking to these Houses of Parliament?
This deal brings back some welfare powers. It brings back some immigration powers. It brings back some bailout powers. It means that the ratchet of the European Court taking power away from this country cannot happen in future.
Rubbish, the Mayor of London said. Tory promises of best behaviour on both sides already forgotten. Then it was the Labour bench's turn to go quiet when Jeremy Corbyn spoke.
Last week, like him, I was in Brussels meeting with heads of government and leaders of European socialist parties, one of whom said to me...
Who are you? A Tory MP shouted. It was the only moment of unity on the Tory benches all afternoon. Some Labour MPs struggled to keep a straight face.
Mr. Speaker, if the party opposite would care to think for a moment about what's going on, one person said to me, and I thought it was quite profound, he said, we are discussing the future of a continent, and one English Tory has reduced it to the issue of taking away benefits from workers and children.
Okay, folks, I'm going to leave that there for now. There was about another minute left. But see, why is this important, ladies and gentlemen? Because it's important because these trading blocks are being pushed right here in the United States as well. And the future of Britain really boils down also to the future, and the European Union also boils down to the future of where we're going to be in the West as well. What they're trying to do is build a new world order through all this regionalism, and we have to pay attention to what's going on across the pond. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America.
And we still fight for all that's right. When the chips are down, we still unite. And we still love this land so dear. We're full of pride, not wrought with fear, as terror learns from overseas. We still stand tall, and we still stand free.
All right, we're back. This is Bruce Ballett bringing us back into the broadcast. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. GovernAmerica.com is the website. GovernAmerica.com. My email address, radio@GovernAmerica.com. And the phone number, if you'd like to call in, is 1-844-6468-376. That's 1-844-646-8376. Or you can remember it by going 1-844-6-GOVERN. That's 844-6-GOVERN. As we continue on here, we're sharing an article from WolfStreet.com, ladies and gentlemen, because we're talking about the British exit from the European Union, the referendum that's coming up in June that David Cameron was pretty much pressured into engineering or holding or calling for. And just to give you a little sample of that, we have Douglas Herbert from France 24 was talking about just how David Cameron went about to do this.
The cabinet reflects the divisions within the Tory party itself. It's interesting. David Cameron himself, he's what people have called a practical Eurosceptic. He's wanted to always get a good deal out of Europe, but if you're to take him at his word, he's never really wanted to leave Europe. And you know, until he actually announced this referendum in January 2013 under great pressure from the Tory Eurosceptics in his own party, he had been very much opposed to the idea of a referendum. He spoke out as recently as June 2012 in Brussels, during a visit to Brussels, against a referendum, saying that, you know, the problem with an in-out referendum is it boils down to you're just giving people two choices. It's an all-or-nothing thing. And David Cameron has always wanted to see a sort of more gray zone, a more nuanced sort of approach to Europe. What made him change his mind is he was literally forced to march towards a referendum by his party. By the right wing of his party, the pressure just became too much, and he was forced to cave into pressure. You know, you'll speak to a lot of people on the Leave side, on the Eurosceptic side, and they will tell you that it was inevitable that Britain was going to have to call a referendum. You know, and other people will say, oh no, David Cameron caved into pressure. Perhaps another prime minister under other circumstances would never have called a referendum. So, you know, there's even opposition over whether or not what we're seeing today, this penultimate step before launching this keep Britain in the EU campaign, whether this was all inevitable, this scenario, arriving at where we are today, staring at this door, waiting for the UK prime minister to step out, make an expected statement of a date for a referendum on whether Britain should stay in Europe. Was this an inevitable historical moment we're waiting for right now? Was it something that could have been averted? Have we all just now just accepted the fact or come to it's just become the conventional wisdom? Of course there was always going to be a referendum. And that was never really a foregone conclusion. It is true that the Eurosceptic current in Britain has been building drip by drip, and sometimes more than that, over the past years and even decades, and that Britain is always been an exception within Europe. Britain has always had its opt-outs. It's not a member of the Eurozone. It's not in the Schengen Free Circulation Zone. It never signed the Charter on Fundamental Rights in the European Union. It's opted out of a lot of police and judicial cooperation conventions. So in many respects,
Britain is
already halfway out the door. The reason it is in Europe and it is a member of the European Union, and this sounds like a tautology, is because it's a member of the European Union. In other words, it is still subject to the European Union treaties. So it's going to be very interesting. You know, a lot of people say that this deal on both sides, that this deal is really tinkering at the edges. It's really, it's a lot of, showmanship and posturing for the public, and that Europe is helping Cameron do all of this posturing, and that the deal itself isn't going to really make that much of a difference in the end in Britain's real relationship with Europe, because for all intents and purposes, on so many different levels, whether we're talking about immigration issues, economic issues, issues of sovereignty, the City of London and financial regulations, there's so many issues on which Britain already is really removing itself from Europe. And you talk about that clause in the EU's founding charter, the founding idea of ever closer union. Another thing that Britain has come away from Brussels, David Cameron came back, being able to sort of opt out of that. Britain will not be obligated to commit itself to ever closer union. You could say ever closer disunion, perhaps. But that's been also another sort of pillar of the European Union that Britain has stepped away from. And some people say, if you're stepping away from that, you're essentially stepping away from the European project.
So it's very interesting, and this is going to be fascinating to watch unfold, because this really, if I had to make a prediction at this point, I would predict that there is no way they're going to allow the people of Britain to vote themselves out. Now, time will tell, but we already see U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman, according to Wall Street, wading into the debate even deeper, reiterating remarks that the U.S. is not going to sign a separate trade deal with the U.K. See, as we explained and talked about repeatedly on this show, these international trade deals create blocks where people outside of the deal can't basically have a market to sell their goods. So they use the carrot and stick approach. Basically, you're whipped across your economy, you're beaten down economically if you don't participate in the block, in the deal. And that's the problem. It creates a club. And if you're not in the club, you can't sell your goods. And if you can't, don't have a market to sell your goods, you're pretty much stuck. You're pretty much stuck. Hopefully you have a big enough market domestically. But as far as economic growth is concerned, as far as dealing with international trade, exporting your goods, it's very limited. And that's how these globalists are accomplishing their goals. They say in this Wolf Street, as a result, British firms could face, quote, crippling Chinese-style tariffs outside the EU, unquote. As Wolf Street reported last year, when Froman fired his first warning shot about Brexit, what they call Brexit, the U.S. has plenty of reasons to be worried, chief among them, the potential disintegration of its biggest trading partner, the European Union. No less concerned is the City of London, which risks losing a hefty chunk of its business to Frankfurt. Most in danger is its dominance of the $5.3 trillion a day foreign exchange market. This dominance, including euro trading, quote, would gradually decline and then end as the flows move to Asia and other European capitals, unquote. Jim Rogers, who co-founded the Quantum Fund in 1973 with George Soros, told Reuters that the dominance, that's what he was talking about, it would gradually decline. And then in the flows move to Asia and other European capitals. When it comes to Brexit doomsaying, no one can hold a candle to HSBC, the money laundering specialists, that just decided to stay in London despite the prospect of Brexit. In a new report, HSBC predicts that the Brexit will have almost apocalyptic consequences for the UK economy, including the potential loss of 20% of sterling's value against the dollar, the destruction of almost all expected GDP growth for 2017, the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs, cost inflation and reduced demand in the retail sector, a housing slowdown in London, problems for air operators as people stop traveling between the UK and the rest of Europe, a prolonged period of stagflation, and to top it all off, increased emissions. So, I mean, they're really ratcheting up the fear factor, ladies and gentlemen. What do we do without all these free trade globalist blocks where countries get together and surrender their sovereignty? What do we do prior to this? We had economies before. But they're just beating the drum, beating the drum, beating the drum. And that I predict that's what they're going to do. They're going to scare the people into voting for their own enslavement. That's the bottom line. Hopefully I'm wrong. But it seems to be that's what they do every time. In the meantime, here domestically, speaking of free trade, We've talked a lot about the Trans-Pacific Partnership on this broadcast. Now it seems that of course, they produced the document in top secret, negotiated by multinational corporations. The people weren't allowed to see it because it's so wonderful for you. And you might just not be able to handle how wonderful it is for you. So we can't let you see it. Well, finally, they posted it. Publicly, the final text was finally released, but now they're tampering with it in secret. Tech Dirt says, in early November, the final text of the TPP was finally released. The United States Trade Representative even posted it, the thing to Medium, pretending that after years of secrecy, it was now being transparent. As we've been told time and time again, the final document is not open to any changes. The only thing left to do was a legal scrub, they called it, which is a final process in which the lawyers comb through the document word by word, basically to make sure that there are no typos or out-and-out errors. The legal scrub is not when any substantial changes can be made. And yet, The eagle-eyed Jeremy Malcolm over at the Electronic Frontier Foundation has spotted an apparent change in the legal scrub of the intellectual property chapter that will massively expand criminal penalties, listeners, for copyright infringing activities that have no impact on the actual market. Technically, the scrub just changed the word paragraph to subparagraph in the following sentence. With regard to copyright and related rights piracy provided for under paragraph 1, a party may limit application of this subparagraph to the cases in which there is an impact on the right holder's ability to exploit the work, performance, or phonogram in the market. Now, they say in this article, even though that they changed paragraph to subparagraph, the impact of that change is massive. As Malcolm explains, what this surreptitious change from paragraph to subparagraph, in its original form, the provision exempted a country from making available any of the criminal procedures and penalties listed above, except in circumstances where there is an impact on the copyright holder's ability to exploit their work in the market. In its revised form, the only criminal provision that a country is exempted from applying in those circumstances is the one to which the footnote is attached, namely the ex officio action provision, which means under this amendment, all of the other criminal procedures and penalties must be available, even if the infringement has absolutely no impact on the right holder's ability to exploit their work in the market. The only enforcement provision that countries have the flexibility to withhold in such cases is the authority of state officials to take legal action into their own hands. He further notes that it's obviously a significant change that could end up criminalizing plenty of activity that is infringing, but which is totally not for profit, and which may have the penalty, may have plenty of legitimate uses. There's been a long push that the legacy copyright players, to use the Trans-Pacific Partnership to ratchet up criminal penalties. And many of the worst proposals were stripped from the agreement. But with this legal scrub, things have moved massively towards criminalization. And that's a problem. Anyway, it goes on from there, and I'll put that article in the show notes. But it looks like, folks, what else are they changing in this document? The original document is bad enough. But if they're monkeying around with it now, so much for transparency, ladies and gentlemen. Everyone needs to be contacting Congress to come out against this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Because what you're seeing over in the European Union right now is just a taste of what we have coming here. As more and more of these overlapping trade blocks undermine national sovereignty, you lose control of your laws, your regulations, your country even more. Now, I realize we already have lost control of much of this. But through the states, you have a potential of getting control back. Once this is pushed outside the country, once it becomes a trade bloc, you have multinational corporations suing your government because you erect unfair barriers to trade. It serves to undermine national sovereignty even more in a major way. You lose more and more. In the meantime, we see from AFP, 10 days to save EU migration system. This is another situation right now that's causing a lot of problems. As Europe, the refugees over there come up from Syria through Turkey and into Greece. Other European countries are closing their borders to the refugees. which is causing them to be trapped in Greece right now.
Migrants and refugees arriving at the Belgian town of Le Pen on the border with France are turned back by police. It comes amid French plans to evict thousands of people from the camp known as the Jungle near Calais. Fearing a potential influx of UK-bound migrants, Belgium has this week reintroduced border controls.
We want to leave this country.
Yeah, to England.
But they no let us to go.
No England. It's no England. Belgium.
Another country. What do we do? What should we do here?
Up to 290 Belgian police officers have been deployed at crossings with France. The Belgian government has said the controls will last as long as necessary. The move is the latest blow to free travel in Europe's Schengen zone. An increasing number of EU member states, most recently Austria, have been tightening their controls, introducing tougher checks, turning people back, saying they just can't take in any more.
Now, keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, under Agenda 21, Chapter 7, it says all countries, where appropriate, should develop and implement resettlement programs that address the specific problems of displaced populations in their respective countries. They talk in Agenda 21, Chapter 7, the overall human settlement objective is to improve the social, economic, and environmental quality of human settlements and the living and working conditions of all people. Well, how's that working out for you folks? As they promote increasingly sea crate containers, and they say in particular improving the conditions for the urban and rural poor. They say such improvement should be based on technical cooperation activities, partnerships, listeners, among the public, private, and community sectors, public-private partnerships, which is corporate fascism, listeners. And participation in the decision-making process by community groups and special interest groups such as women, indigenous people, the elderly, and the disabled. These approaches, they say, should form the core principles of national settlement strategies. In developing these strategies, countries will need to set priorities among the 8 program areas in this chapter in accordance with their national plans and objectives, taking fully into account their social and cultural capabilities. They talk in Chapter 7 about providing adequate shelter for all. Adequate. What's adequate? Well, they define adequate. They say access to safe and healthy shelter is essential to a person's physical, psychological, social, and economic well-being, and should be a fundamental part of the national and international action. The right to adequate housing is a basic human right and is enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Despite this, it is estimated that at the present time, at least 1 billion people do not have access to safe and healthy shelter, and that if appropriate action is not taken, this number will increase dramatically by the end of the century and beyond. Well, how are we doing with that, ladies and gentlemen, with our global economy is putting more and more people out of work? Well, your jobs are being outsourced and you can't afford adequate housing. What's adequate? How do you define adequate? That's my question. But the resettlement programs, listeners, resettlement programs are part of the overall UN agenda. There is a document from the United Nations Habitat, UN Habitat, called the Global Housing Strategy. The Global Housing Strategy Framework. They say in this document, which is being followed today, the UN Habitat Global Housing Strategy is a collaborative global movement towards adequate housing for all and improving access to housing in general and the living conditions of slum dwellers in particular. Its main objective is to assist member states. Okay, first of all, how are they doing with promoting and improving conditions for slum dwellers, where we have massive amounts of migrants flowing across Europe right now? These people don't have adequate housing, do they? Well, gee, wasn't it United Nations operations that created the war zones in the first place that made all these people not have adequate housing? Their homelands were destroyed. Seems to me like before the United States and the UN got involved, these people had adequate housing in their home countries. Why are they being created? Why is homelessness being created even as the UN pushes adequate housing? Seems to me to be a little bit of a disconnect. Don't you think so? They say to achieve the goal of adequate housing for all, the backbone of the strategy will rely on the principle of inclusive cities, ladies and gentlemen. Inclusive cities. Sounds all wonderful, doesn't it? What does it mean? What do they mean by inclusive cities? Gee, I guess it means when foreigners flood your land, you have to include them in your cities. We're all just one great big global melting pot. They say inclusive cities should be the foundation for sustainable urban development. Inclusive cities are achieved by maintaining or mainstreaming human rights in urban development, including housing and slum upgrading, to ensure social integration, ladies and gentlemen. Social integration and aiming for the elimination of the urban divide. Doesn't that just sound wonderful? The elimination of the urban divide. Everybody should just be all integrated, living together peacefully. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. And again, folks, we come back to what's going on. What's going on in Europe right now? How do we know it doesn't work that way? Because we see with different cultures come culture clashes. We have migrants now sexually assaulting women in foreign countries. And as a result, now the migrants are going over there. Animosity has been created against the migrants. So retaliation against the migrants, because people are getting increasingly upset in Greece and other places. Here's an RT report about the backlash against migrants.
UN Refugee Agency has slammed European nations that are restricting their border crossings, blocking the path of thousands of migrants.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is concerned by recent restrictive practices adopted in a number of European countries, creating chaos at several border points and putting particular pressure on Greece as it struggles to deal with larger numbers of people in need of accommodation and services.
Well, the bottleneck at the Macedonian border began when Skopje started only allowing refugees from Iraq and Syria through, leaving thousands of others stranded in Greece. Well, those migrants, mostly from Afghanistan, are transported to refugee centres in Athens now. However, the country's whole reception system could be overwhelmed in just 8 days. That's according to aid group Doctors Without Borders. Those who don't meet the criteria as asylum seekers are supposed to leave Greece after 1 month. But the chief of the European border agency, Frontex, thinks almost none of them will return to Turkey from where they entered Greece. He adds that if other nations don't start taking in the migrants, they're bound to stay in the country. We ask people in Greece what they think of the migrant situation there.
Actually, I feel betrayed because all the refugees come in Athens and the other countries don't even help.
It is unfair, the closing of the borders. Our European fellow states don't treat us justly.
It was not something that surprised me that they're not helping us now. We are a country in a terrible economic crisis and we can't support all these people. I hope they will understand that, but I don't think they will.
I believe that this is very wrong, mainly for the refugees who suffer and have to move from one place to the other. It is also unfair towards Greece, because currently we do not have the proper infrastructure to host so many refugees.
But why is this happening there? Greece is the main point of entry for sea arrivals to Europe. People from the Mideast and North Africa first head to Turkey. From there, they take sea routes to the Greek Aegean Islands. Then it's on to mainland Greece and further into Europe via the so-called Balkan route. We spoke to a former Greek diplomat who thinks that Athens is in a dire situation.
Okay, stay with us, folks. We got to take the top of the hour break. Hour number two is straight ahead, and we'll continue here in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Govern America. All right, we're back. That's Steve Doerr bringing us back. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, and this continues to be the 27th of February, 2016, as we're watching the potential disintegration of the European Union, and I'd be surprised if they let it happen. But this seems to be what's being pushed by certain people, which I think is long overdue. Whether the people will stand up and do the right thing or not remains to be seen, however. But before the break, we were talking about the United Nations Habitat Agenda and how everything they say they want to do seems to be the exact opposite of what they really accomplish. And we were sharing a report from Russia Today before the break, and I want to get back to that report because they're talking about the Greece refugee, the situation over there, which was engineered by the globalists, I believe on purpose. They want to create massive amounts of people with no place to go, because what this does, these cross-border floods manage to accomplish, is to weaken national infrastructures, weaken national sovereignty, weaken national cultures, and create international problems. And any international problem that's engineered, ladies and gentlemen, is an international problem that can be solved by an international body. We're seeing more and more of these things all the time. We've talked about these pandemics, another good example. And then, of course, there's terrorism, another good example. You notice how many different things today are so-called international crises. That's the Hegelian dialectic, because they bring about the crisis to engineer the solution. And the solution is your world government from their standpoint. Anyway, getting back to the situation with RT.
Islands. Then it's on to mainland Greece and further into Europe via the so-called Balkan route. We spoke to a former Greek diplomat who thinks that Athens is in a dire situation.
Taking into consideration that Greece is also going through the economic crisis that has been created by the European Union and the measures that it has been imposed upon Greece, I don't think that Greece could last very much longer with this. After a short time, we shall have reactions from the local population, in spite of the fact that Greeks are very hospitable. After a certain moment, we cannot take more. I mean, it's physically impossible. And the solution for me is for the EU member states to start taking refugees according to their participation in the Syria war.
So PBS NewsHour did a piece on how these refugees are being targeted. To more detail, I want to play you a little bit of what they had to say.
Eden is struggling to accommodate 165,000 people.
Now, that was the last report. We were talking about Greece. This is what we're talking about Sweden here.
Eden is struggling to accommodate 165,000 people who have applied for asylum there amid the refugee crisis. Now, in a reversal of its open door policy, the government says as many as half could face deportation. A growing right-wing reaction to the migrant influx has fueled tensions. From Stockholm, special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reports.
Sweden fashions itself as the world's humanitarian conscience and safe harbor for more refugees per capita than any other European nation. But it's been shaken by a series of incidents that have ruptured that image.
I would say that Sweden's social structures are under severe stress.
Magnus Ranstorp is an expert on extremism in Scandinavia.
It's a cocktail of various ingredients which makes society extremely polarized, and the government is having a really difficult time dealing with this.
As a refugee here, I would say it's pretty hostile.
Tina Morad is a Kurdish political scientist who fled from northern Iraq as a child and now advocates on behalf of fellow refugees.
We've noticed a lot of activities for the past week at least, where you have Nazis and racists crossing the streets and demonstrating against the refugees arriving to Sweden.
These are right-wing vigilantes, including football hooligans, apparently attacking immigrants. This precinct is where young Moroccans hang out. Many have acquired a reputation as petty criminals and troublemakers.
So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. There are no winners in all of this. The refugees, you know, to the degree to which some of them are not doing nefarious things. Now, of course, this is just... And I have to question whether the PBS is slanting things to make everyone feel sorry for the refugees, but you do have to feel sorry for them to a certain extent because they've been made homeless by the wars, by the various engineered scenarios, all being fought in the name of peace, but at the same time, what it really is being fought is to further business opportunities. We got to get somebody in Syria that we can work with here. And this is how the whole global thing works, listeners. Economic hitmen, inner countries, the intelligentsia. If it's not somebody that the State Department can work with, they enter in, they overthrow the government, they create civil wars everywhere they go. And the refugees are engineered and consequently cause havoc in neighboring countries. And this is how the UN Habitat Agenda works, where you've got to relocate them under international rules. And the flooding continues. We see also UN Habitat African representatives set priorities for African urban agenda. See, not all these refugees are coming from Syria. Some of these refugees are coming from Africa. And also, we have to keep in mind, the United Nations, along with the U.S. State Department, made Libya unstable. That was a total UN operation that our Nobel Peace Prize-winning president engineered. ChannelsTV.com says African representatives meeting at UN Habitat Regional Conference in Abuja have set 7 priorities to fast-track urbanization in Africa, accompanied by sustainable development, social integration, listeners, and equity. After 3 days of deliberation, 7 broad priorities were set by 52 countries for Africa's urban agenda, and the UN Habitat Regional Conference in Nigeria drew to a conclusion. The representatives have agreed that there are no general solutions to issues of urbanization, but say that there are a set of frameworks that can serve as guides. Anyway, that's going on. That just concluded, actually. The Habitat 3 Regional Conference. 7 strategic priorities, they say, have been set. And what would be in what would in future be known as the Abuja Declaration. Among the priorities of the conference is the enhancement of people-centered, people-centered urban and human settlements through access to affordable and adequate basic services. Now, folks, aren't you so thrilled that everything today is adequate? I guess it's better than inadequate, but I'd be very interested to know what definitions. How do you define adequate? Affordable and adequate basic services. Basic services. Housing and land, urban safety and security, and upgrading of slums. So you're still going to live in a slum. It'll just be an upgraded slum. Also among the priorities is the allocation of adequate financial resources. Enhancement of the connectivity between rural and urban areas, and empowering local governments to deliver adequate shelter to citizens. The focus is urbanization that accelerates structural transformation for inclusive growth and strengthening of institutions and systems to promote transformative change in settlements. The United Nations Habitat Office is optimistic that these strategic priorities will set Africa out towards the global urban goal. Every government now has the task to set about implementation, each nation according to its level of development. Anyway, that's going on as everything is adequate. Just like Obamacare. Adequate. Very expensive, however. I wonder how many people who are currently have Obamacare find it adequate. As people who used to have health coverage are seeing it disappear in many respects. The sad part about it is, according to The Atlantic, most people, actually the Associated Press recently asked 1,033 adults what they thought Medicare for All, a cornerstone of Bernie Sanders' presidential candidate, what they thought of it. Now, keep in mind, Bernie Sanders is a closet communist, in my opinion. He admitted to being a democratic socialist. Well, isn't that the same thing as a closet communist? I think so. Anyway, they asked what they thought of his cornerstone of his campaign. When asked their view of single-payer health care, what such a system is often called, the respondents, well, they don't even know what it is, listeners. 39% thought it was great, placing the private health insurance system with a single government-run, taxpayer-funded plan that would cover medical, dental, vision, and long-term care. With 33% opposed. Gee, there's an awful lot of 33s in this article. You think they're trying to tell us something? Anyway, when they ask whether they'd be willing to either pay higher taxes for such a plan or give up their own employer-sponsored plans for a government-run insurance plan, they were decidedly less bullish. 39% said they would oppose a plan that meant either of those steps. And support thinned further as the pollsters brought up the other potential pitfalls of single-payer systems. Anyway, the problem has always been an electorate that doesn't know what's going on. The problem has always been people don't pay attention. And unfortunately, I don't see that changing anytime soon. Now, we're talking about these migrant situations. And the mess that is the European Union, and how wonderful everything everyone says it's going to be when we do the same thing over here. And in fact, they're doing the same thing over here with various trade agreements, and now Obama is going to Cuba. Wow, this is something everyone can look forward to, Obama going to Cuba. He just, in his weekly podcast, made the announcement recently.
This week we made it official. I'm going to Cuba. When Michelle and I go to Havana next month, it will be the first visit of a U.S. president to Cuba in nearly 90 years. And it builds on the decision I made more than a year ago to begin a new chapter in our relationship with the people of Cuba. You see, I believe that the best way to advance American interests and values, and the best way to help the Cuban people improve their lives, is
to sell out American interests and values.
By normalizing relations between our governments and increasing contacts between our peoples. I've always said that change won't come to Cuba overnight. But as Cuba opens up, it will mean more opportunity and resources for ordinary Cubans.
Now, isn't it interesting how he admits that this is all for Cuba and all for ordinary Cubans? Gee, you know, the listening to this guy, you'd think he was the president of Cuba. I mean, where is the benefit to the American people, Mr. Obama? How is this going to benefit us? But no, no, he doesn't care about us. He cares about benefiting the people of Cuba, the Cuban government, the Cuban youth, the Cuba, Cuba, Cuba. Why don't you just go move to Cuba and run for political office there, you little scumbag?
American companies are starting to do business in Cuba, helping to nurture private enterprise and giving Cuban entrepreneurs new opportunities. With new Wi-Fi hotspots, more Cubans are starting to go online and get information from the outside world. In both our countries, there's overwhelming support for this new relationship. And in Cuba today, for the first time
Hold
in
on
a
second.
Half century.
Wait a minute. I can't let that lie stand. Ladies and gentlemen, where do you hear anybody talking about how much they want to open up Cuba? Now, maybe there's a lot of Cubans in Florida that are there right now, and they're wanting to see it opened up. But, you know, generally speaking, I don't see a whole lot of demand among the American people for an opening up of Cuba. You know, I really don't, you know, care to see anything like this. So his notion is a lie.
There is hope for a different future, especially among Cuba's young people who have such extraordinary talent and potential just waiting to be unleashed.
And there you have it, listeners. The youth of Cuba. This is what part of this is about. Let's import their young people into the United States. We need more and more of these people in here. Well, for other reasons, to pay for our healthcare system. They got to be the little global slaves. Out of the frying pan, into the global fire. Oh, these young people in Cuba, they just have such enormous potential. Uh-huh.
My visit will be an opportunity to keep moving forward. I'll meet with President Castro to discuss how we can continue normalizing relations, including making it easier to trade and easier for Cubans to access the internet and start their own businesses. As I did when I met President Castro last year, I'll speak candidly about our serious differences with the Cuban government, including on democracy and human rights. I'll reaffirm that the United States will continue to stand up for universal values like freedom of speech and assembly and religion. I'll meet with members of Cuba's civil society, courageous men and women who give voice to the aspirations of the Cuban people. I'll meet with Cuban entrepreneurs to learn how we can help them start new ventures.
Now, isn't that wonderful that he's meeting with Cuban entrepreneurs? As you folks have a hard time putting a roof over your head, American businesses, small businesses especially, can't compete. They're going under. And yet he's going to spend your money, because that's what this really boils down to, is the American people are going to have to spend pony up to build Cuba's economy. Multinational corporations are excited about this because they're looking to exploit this. More businesses, more U.S. firms are going to be moving to Cuba as this goes forward. And exactly what has changed? What kind of what kind of changes have taken place in the Cuban government that lets us know that they're moving away from communism? Nothing. How has anything changed? And this is the point of the problem, listeners. I don't see any difference whatsoever. Why are we doing this now? Because we have to have the whole hemisphere be a part of the Union of the Americas. And Cuba's got to come in line with what the U.S. is trying to do, creating a regional bloc, which includes literally the entire West, the entire American Union. This is about the New World Order. That's exactly what this is about.
And I'll speak directly to the Cuban people about the values we share and how I believe we can be partners as they work for the future they want.
What values do we share, Mr. Obama? Because, you know, I look at the Constitution, and I don't see any of the values, American values, that are expressed there being upheld. What values are you talking about here? I'd like to see what values. Where's your values? Because they certainly don't match mine.
We're still in the early days of our new relationship with the Cuban people. This transformation will take time, but I'm focused on the future, and I'm confident that my visit will advance the goals that guide us, promoting American interests and values and a better future for the Cuban people.
For the Cuban people.
A future of more freedom and more opportunity.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the freedom. Yeah, the freedom is just squirting out every orifice, isn't it?
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah.
And to the people of Cuba, nos vemos en La Habana.
Well, unbelievable. Unbelievable. In the meantime, we have more and more Cubans flooding in to the United States, very predictably, as this will continue to go forward under this Obama plan.
Alicia Garcia Valdez says she's running out of time to turn this old house into a temporary shelter for up to 200 Cuban migrants.
How many days do you have to get ready?
20.
They'd be among the thousands of Cubans who could soon arrive in the Miami area after being stranded in Costa Rica since November.
Thousands of Cubans, listeners, thousands.
That guy is from Costa Rica right now.
Valdez, a Cuban immigrant herself, is in touch with some of them every day.
He's coming to Miami?
Yes, he's coming to Miami.
She says groups like her nonprofit agency are not prepared to support so many so fast.
I don't receive any help from the city, from the state, from nobody. The only help we already receive is from the community.
Is this a crisis?
Yes.
South Florida is already home to the largest number of Cubans outside Cuba. Thousands have fled here in the past year alone, many fearing that as relations improve between Washington and Havana, their window to get special immigration status in the U.S. will close. Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado says local resettlement agencies will struggle to handle and house even more Cuban migrants.
The agencies are telling us, Mayor, we cannot take any more people. We're running out of funds. We're running out of places to...
Now, as you listen to this news clip here, think about what's happening over in Europe right now. Think about the parallels, ladies and gentlemen, as we were talking earlier about the refugees from Syria going through Turkey into Greece and other countries over there closing their borders because they can't handle anymore, and these refugees being trapped in Greece and all the animosity that's being created there, all the backlash that's being created there. What you have being built here, ladies and gentlemen, with this flood of Cubans, the flood of Mexicans, the flood of everybody else from various countries in this great big UN habitat utopia that's being built. What you have here are the seeds of civil war being engineered. Because as time goes on, there's going to be increasingly strife. There's going to be cultural clashes taking place. And people are not going to be able to stand it anymore. They're not going to take it anymore. So this is a very dangerous situation, but this is exactly what the global planners, including Obama, are doing.
To house them.
This area has accepted thousands just in the past year. So what's a few thousand more?
What's a few thousand more?
Human for us as a city to have people living in the streets for several weeks, just waiting for their papers.
But Miami-Dade County official Curtis Summerhoff says the region is prepared.
There's a network.
Especially since he expects the new migrants won't all come at the same time or to the same place.
We have a lot of cities, and we have a lot of ability to, I think, absorb a population, or in case of the migrant population we're talking about, quite well here.
Oh, sure, just bring them on.
Here's somebody saying that this is a crisis, or that they're worried about this influx. Are they exaggerating?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that it's exaggerating for the mayor and the circumstances in the city of Miami. We have this expectation that the federal government's going to make sure that the money and services are here to support these folks.
How confident are you that the federal government will step in if it's
happening? I am not confident at all. They have not responded our calls.
So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Flooding your country, and this is more in line with the Cloward-Piven strategy, because as all these people come in here, they're going to be, what? Supported by you. Your welfare rolls will explode, because they don't have jobs, and when they do have jobs, it'll be jobs that you don't have. Oh, but don't worry, listeners. They're just here to do the jobs the Americans won't do, right? Incredible. Incredible treachery. Now, we also have a situation in the Middle East right now as people flood your country. You have to be concerned about pipelines of terrorists, jihadists. The situation is volatile there, and they've already said they're going to take some here. But over in Syria, there has been a supposed ceasefire declared, and there are some that are saying the ceasefire is hogwash. Let me do this in reverse. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll start here. Here's Press TV.
The U.S. Secretary of State says world powers meeting on Syria have agreed to implement a nationwide ceasefire in the war-torn country within a week. John Kerry made the remarks in Munich during a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, and United Nations Special Envoy to Syria, Stephane de Mistura. Kerry added that the parties also agreed to end hostilities and provide humanitarian access in Syria. He further stressed that humanitarian aid will begin flowing into besieged areas in Syria this week. The Russian top diplomat also said that access will be secured in all besieged areas in Syria. Lavrov, however, stressed that the ceasefire will not affect the campaign against terrorist groups in the Arab state. He added that the parties agreed to coordinate military efforts in Syria for the first time, noting that collective efforts are needed to end the worsening humanitarian situation in Syria.
Now, one thing that's interesting about the ceasefire, according to various sources, is it's not evenly applied. Now, understand, ladies and gentlemen, this is kind of like the gun control argument. People who are not law-abiding are not going to abide necessarily by a ceasefire. And so this is the whole ridiculous aspect of all of this. Richard Spencer from The Telegraph out of the UK.
I don't think anyone really expects this ceasefire to really lead to peace in Syria, certainly not immediately. The aim is to deconflict the situation, to reduce the level of violence so that talks can take place. This seems to be a fairy tale. The astonishing thing about this ceasefire deal, which was negotiated by the international powers, is that it doesn't bind any of them to cease fire. All the international powers say that they are fighting terrorists in Syria, and the terms of this ceasefire is that it doesn't include anyone who's a UN-designated terrorist. So the outside powers don't have to cease fire. The regime doesn't have to cease fire because it also says it is fighting terrorists. And the terrorists themselves, the UN-designated groups like Islamic State, like Jabhat al-Nusra, the local branch of al-Qaeda, are also excluded from the terms of the deal. So the only people who have to observe the terms of the deal are the so-called moderate rebels, the Western-backed rebels, who are also the only people involved in the war on the ground who haven't been accused of major war crimes. So this is a ceasefire deal.
Well, I don't know about that last part. But anyway, this is just getting very interesting over there. Bottom of the hour break. We'll continue on the other side. This is Govern America.
We've come too far to lose it all. This our country anymore. Sweet Lady Liberty cries, it's up to us to dry her eyes.
That's Bruce Bellett bringing us back into the broadcast. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. And it's the 27th of February, 2016. It's hard to believe the year is already going so fast. It'll be like a blink of an eye before we get back into 2017. Or get into. Before you know it, it'll be over, is what I'm saying. It's amazing to me how fast this life goes, ladies and gentlemen. So make it count. Make it count. And it's fascinating to me watching all of this stuff transpire before us. We're living really in some frightful times, yes, but also some very incredibly exciting times as we're literally watching history unfold at breakneck speed every single day. And the European Union, the crisis with the refugees, the banking situation on every front, the various wars, It's fascinating to live this history. And we have front row seats. Because we're going through it. For better, for worse. Anyway, before the break, we were playing audio from Richard Spencer from The Telegraph. And he was talking about the ceasefire over there with Syria. The fact that it's not evenly applied. And he made the statement, I said at the end, just before going into that last break, that I'm not so sure about, because what he said was that the only ones that the ceasefire doesn't apply to, or it doesn't apply to, the Western-backed rebels. The problem with the Western-backed rebels, as we've said so often on this show, is the fact that, again, these people are basically, they are the terrorists. We are backing the terrorists over there. And we've talked often about this on this show. And I find it interesting because, you know, last week we had people on this broadcast calling in talking about how wonderful Ben Carson was. And I don't think Ben Carson is wonderful because, honestly, I think he's just another establishment candidate towing the party line, listeners. He's talked about the merits of torture, waterboarding, various things regarding the war on terror. It was pointed out last week about his vaccination record. He's evidently pro-vaccination. He was also questioned recently by Derek Brones of the Activist Post on the subject of U.S. funding, U.S. government funding of ISIS. And I think this was really an instructive moment for everybody who thinks Ben Carson is the cat's meow. Listen to what he, listen to how this interaction went.
Dr. Carson, how would you handle the escalating conflict in Syria? Kerry's talking about bringing more troops for this safe zone. How would you deal with that conflict?
Well, first you have to keep your eye on what you're doing. What we're trying to do is eliminate ISIS. That's primary right now. I think in Syria, we ought to also be concerned about the Syrian refugees and where we can resettle them.
Okay, first of all, Mr. Carson, it's not our job to resettle them. But see, if you're playing the global government game, as we just covered in the last hour, Agenda 21, Chapter 7, all countries where appropriate should develop and implement resettlement programs. So it's the UN agenda is where we have to settle them. No, we don't have to play the UN game. And anybody who is a president that cares about the sovereignty of the United States should be saying, you know what? The refugees are not our problem. We're going to do what's best for the United States. That's the way it should be. I'm tired of representatives selling us out, ladies and gentlemen. It's about dang time here that we have some people in office that care about this country, not the global scale. I don't care about the global world. I don't care about the sovereignty of the UN state. I don't care about regional blocs. I don't care about... Look, if we quit making the wars, maybe we wouldn't have to worry about resettling the refugees that the wars create. Did you ever think of that? Why doesn't Ben Carson address the multinational corporations that are causing all these wars, that are behind all this push, as the State Department says, oh, we got to further the brand, man. We got to have a powerful brand, Brand America. I'm tired of multinational corporations running the show, running the world, international banking cartels. It's time the people got wise to this and put a stop to it. And blindly following candidates is not going to get the job done, ladies and gentlemen.
And if you look at Alasaka province in the northeast section, which is about the size of Lebanon, it's a perfectly good location. It's controlled by the Christians and the Kurds and the Sunnis with an international peacekeeping force there.
International peacekeeping force. Would that be the UN international force, ladies and gentlemen? Yeah, you know, the ones that wage peace at the barrel of a gun, at the barrel of a tank. At the barrel of, well, oh, I don't know, drones that bomb innocent people everywhere they go?
Could be a wonderful solution for that. And then as far as Al-Assad is concerned, Obviously, we want to maintain a position in negotiating his replacement.
Okay, why would it be our job to do that, Mr. Carson? What business do we have meddling into the affairs of Syria? Why is it our job here in the United States to worry about who's the leader of Syria? If Al-Assad and the Syrian people want him there, then hey, let him be there. And if the organic Syrian rebels, if there is such a thing, they really want to rebel against Al-Assad, hey, let them try. Let them deal with it if they think they can overthrow him. It shouldn't be our job to meddle. And that is exactly, ladies and gentlemen, why the rest of the world is pissed off at the United States. They're tired of us meddling into their affairs. And we don't have the resources to do it anymore. The United States is 19, or if you believe the official numbers, we have a deficit. Well, we have a national debt of $19 trillion. And we know that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's nowhere near the real national debt. We're thoroughly bankrupt. Our currency's hanging by a thread. We have a central bank that's criminalized and has been since the day it was founded. We've got our own domestic issues here, but see, there it is, really, in a nutshell. Why do we have to do this? Because we have to prop up the U.S. dollar. That's why we got to do it. We've got to maintain U.S. dollar hegemony over the world. That's the name of the game. That's why the wars take place. Everything has to do with this world order, world peace. Oh, isn't it so wonderful?
And trying to seek out a long-term peace settlement for that country.
What about the U.S.'s role in funding ISIS and partially funding the rebels that became ISIS?
Okay, now you should have seen, and I will put this video in the show notes, because when he asked the question, what about the U.S. role in funding ISIS? You should have seen the look that came over Ben Carson's face. It's like, he asked a question that nobody was ever supposed to ask that question.
It's the moderates in Syria.
That's a very difficult thing, but...
I bet it's difficult.
Obviously, you know, al-Nusra and some of the other rebel groups, you know, who are fighting the people that we are fighting, can have, an ameliorating effect if we work together. But it's a very complex situation.
It's not that complex, Mr. Carson. It's really not. It's real simple, actually. You quit funding them, quit building them up, quit leaving them military equipment that they can seize. Yeah, it's really not that difficult at all. Actually, it's very simple. You leave it alone and let them deal with their own issues. And guess what? It'll take care of itself. It's the problem is we're creating all this terrorism worldwide.
In mind, and what we have to do is not spend all of our time working on that. We need to eliminate ISIS because they want to destroy us, and we have to keep our eye on the prize and not get distracted.
Should we eliminate funding for those rebel groups?
All right. Now he said one more thing. I want to get this final piece in here. Because he said one more thing, should we eliminate funding?
Destroy us, and we have to keep our eye on the prize and not get distracted.
Should we eliminate funding for those rebel groups to help stop ISIS's rise?
It depends on the rebel group, and it depends on what they've been doing.
It depends upon the rebel group. This profoundly demonstrates the complete ignorance that Ben Carson has of the Middle East. Either that, or it demonstrates that he's exactly one of the players. And I think it's the latter rather than the former. I don't think he's ignorant at all. I think he knows exactly what he's talking about. He's one of them, ladies and gentlemen. He's an establishment candidate. Now, will he get it into the White House? No, I don't think so. But the fact that he says it depends upon the specific group, whether we're going to fund them or not, demonstrates that he has either no knowledge or he's willfully blind of the fact that you don't know who your enemy is over there. As much as you've tried, let's assume for a minute the United States is deliberately trying to fund good groups. Well, there is no such thing as a, quote, good group, because the members of groups, which groups are all made of members, they flood from one group to the other. You give them funding, you give them military equipment. It always ends up in some other group's hand. Because when they're overthrown, then the weaponry and stuff ends up in somebody else's hands. And how do you know who's who in the first place? In these war zones, there is no good guy, bad guy. There are just various people with different agendas. Everything is not clear cut. Now, we have a caller on the line. I think this is John in Tennessee. I'll tell you what, I'm going to go ahead and take John, and then I'm going to continue here because we've got information. We talked about the origins of ISIS before. Ben Swan has done a really good piece on this subject. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, John in Tennessee. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
You know, you provoked me to call, Darren. I agree with you. Ben Carson is their candidate. It's sad because he's a very intelligent man. He's a very smart man. A doggone brain surgeon, man. He can open you up and fix your brain, but he doesn't have the knowledge to understand who the enemy is, who ISIS is. You know, ISIS really does want to destroy us. The only problem is ISIS. Here's a tongue twister. ISIS is who you think they is. ISIS is someone and something completely different than what you believe. We have been taught and preached to and encouraged to believe that Israel is the chosen state. But there, if you believe the book, Darren, it says those who say they are Jews and are not. There's only one race of people, one nation in this world that says they're Jewish, and they're not. So, Ben, ISIS is not who you think they are, or are not, whatever the proper pronoun is, probably are not who you think they are. And that's what we think. You know, it's dangerous. He may know the truth, but he's right. It is a sticky situation. Because
Well, I tell you who I think they are. I think they're paid mercenaries.
Well, I think that it's the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service, to be truthful with you. I think that 1990 interview was telling the truth. And I think that if Ben Carson does know and he were to say and come out with it, he probably had a look on his face. If I had to guess, well, how am I going to answer this? Because if I come with the truth of what I know to be true, it could cost me my life. Because there's people, you got to kind of play dumb. But for me, you know, it's pretty clear. We're being lied to. Many, 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 many people are being deceived. They think the truth is true when it's really a con and a lie. And until we come as a nation and as a people around the world realize that there are no good governments on this planet, there really isn't. Our nation is not what we were taught it was. It's not a, you know, think about the songs, Darren, when we were young. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty. Well, what country is that? Because I'm not living there.
Yeah.
You know?
John, for some reason, you're real soft today. Are you on something other than you usually are?
No, I've got...
Oh,
I've
that's
got
better.
A wind protector. Well, my mic may have dropped down.
But yeah, that's much
really,
better.
You know, I think that's what it is, Darren, is that, you know, we don't have the self, I guess the introspection or the desire to really call it what it is. We look at this country and we've been taught that it's the best place on earth. I'm so sick of hearing that. Now, granted, I've never lived anywhere else, so I don't know. So me being honest enough to say, well, I don't know if they're the best place on earth or not, how can anyone that wants to be honest say with all honesty and sincerity, it's the best place on earth? You don't know that because you haven't been living on every place on earth or in every place on earth.
Well, I know that
the world, man.
There's other countries that are freer in certain respects than we are. And there are people who have gone down to some of the Central American countries, and yeah, politically they're not free, but in other ways, people are left alone. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess you have to kind of pick and choose. But there's a lot of people leaving the United States of America because they can't pay the taxes.
Well, so economically, when it really comes down to it, is there anything really that is good government, good controlling of the mind on this earth, in the flesh, in governments created by man, and the creator of the government doesn't even realize that they've given the creation power over the creator. Everything is upside down, and we're okay with, not you and I, and not people that are alert and aware, but for the most part, people are okay with that. Hey, we made them. They're not going to mess us over. It's all for our good. They love us. That's why they're taxing you to death. That's why they put you in debt servitude. That's why they reconstructed America. That's why they made you a slave to debt, using a monetary system that you can buy with cash, but yet never own it, because the truth is the truth. And when your grandparents said, John, you can't pay off debt. You can't pay down debt with debt. And I said, yeah, Grandpa, I know that. To this day, I'm left with no choice but a system that tells me I can pay debt with debt. And a government that says boldly, if you don't let us increase our spending limit, we won't be able to pay our bills. And then jump on you and I and everyone else that may find ourselves in that situation because of their manipulation and debasing of the currency and destruction of the economy, and all of a sudden, the slave is the bad guy, when the slave master is the one that has control over the economy.
Yeah.
We're living in la-la land, Darren, and people have got scales on their eyes and their ears full of wax, and their brain is mummified because of that little magic box that they sit in front of with a six-pack of beer watching people kick a football or push a piece of rubber down an ice rink.
Yep.
And thinking, this is the life. I got a 97-inch TV and a 12-pack of beer and loans out my yin-yang, and I'm a happy camper. I'm free. Greatest place on earth.
Yeah, in the meantime, the mail... The credit card offers come in the mail from Chase, and in the corner of the envelope is Chase Freedom. Chase Freedom.
Yeah, and then you pull out your master's card, pay for it with your master's card. And then when you begin to pay the principal on your house note, you've been such a good mortgage holder, we want to refinance your house. We want to restart your interest. You're about to get out of debt.
Yeah.
We like you.
And that's a little scam I got wise to, too. What that's about is resetting your interest rate, because your interest rate is front-loaded. So by the time you've just, paid off a lot of your loan, you've paid the interest already on your account. Then they're wanting to redo it so that they can reset the interest.
You to get into the HARP plan. Feel like you're in heaven, get the HARP loan, start it over again, folks, because we don't want you out of debt. You get out of debt, and the economy will surely, it's already going to collapse. Do you realize, and I know you do, that if you didn't have any of that green stuff in your wallet and no one else was using that green stuff, this economy would not, could not, no way, no how exist. It wouldn't work.
Well, if we had some medium of exchange other than the funny money system, which was operated on by the bankers, and people engaged in trade with each other, barter with each other, I think other economies would exist. Now, where they're headed, though, with this whole thing, as you know, is to eliminate cash. To try to engineer control. And I think when that happens, I think you're going to see people begin to flock away from, at least there'll be people will go back to bartering things because they have no choice. Everything else will be basically tracked. And to get away from tracking, you'll have people engineering things. Hey, John, I want to get your take on something here. Because I've got, there's something very interesting that has emerged, another technology, and it's called TechTats. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but there is a company now that's coming out with, that's now putting biometric identifiers in tattoos. Listen to this.
Here at Chaotic Moon Studios, we're exploring a new frontier of biowearables with a project we're calling TechTats.
So this is really going beyond what the fitness tracker is. And we're right now looking into the medical field specifically because there's a lot of monitoring devices that take up a lot of room and space. So rather than going to the doctor once a year to get your physical, this tech tattoo could be something that you just put on your body once a year and it monitors everything that they would do in a physical and sends that to your doctor. And if there's an issue, they could call you. So the tech tattoos can really tie in everything into one package. So it can look at early signs of fever, your vital signs, heart rate, everything that it needs to look at to notify you that you're getting sick or your child's getting sick. So another beautiful thing that Tech Tattoo kind of takes over and disrupts the market is in the banking industry. We carry wallets around and they're so vulnerable. With a Tech Tattoo, you can carry all your information on your skin, and when you want your credit card information or your ID, you can pull that up automatically through the system. So the great thing about this idea is that it not only serves a really awesome purpose, but it can also be really aesthetically fun. So tech tats are something that I'm passionate about and our team here at Chaotic Mood is very passionate about, and we're excited for the public to see what we've been creating and to really change the industry of technology with something like the temporary tattoo. And Chaotic Moon is excited to bring it to you in the near future.
What do you think of that?
Well, right off the bat, the first thing I noticed, first of all, that's psychological speech. Even the cadence and the intonation of the words, the inflection is all psychological. You think about this. And look back at the 2010 TED conference and look at how Bill Gates spoke. He used the same cadence, the same, almost the same number of syllables, and they're presenting it in such a way as to say, well, you don't want to be outside the herd mentality, do you? They tell you all of the glorious benefits of tech tats. Well, it's kind of like what I've been hearing all my life, you know, not only this cashless society, but the mark of the beast.
There you go.
A chip or a tattoo or a barcode, but it's incremental, smooths you. Hey, it's nothing that's going to hurt you. You know, it's almost like, in fact, I was listening to something about it. I think it was the day before yesterday. But it's actually a type of, not psychological, although it is, but it goes even deeper than that. It's, what's the science of the brain that Ben Carson's involved in? You know, that's where we're going with that. And if you listen to Ben Carson speak, he speaks much in the same way. It's short thoughts. It's never anything personal. It's all a set cadence to kind of bring you along.
We have to take the top of the hour break. You want to hold over?
Yeah, I got a few minutes.
Okay, all right, let's stay with us, folks. John in Tennessee's on the line, and you're welcome to call in too, 1-844-646-8376, 1-844-646-8376. This is Govern America. We'll be back.
night under these stars and stripes.
Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. The website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com. Again, my email address, if you'd like to get in touch, is radio@governamerica.com. That's radio@governamerica.com. And the call-in number, if you'd like to join us, 1-844-646-8376. 1-844-6-GOVERN. And John in Tennessee is on the line right now. And John, you were said you had a couple more things you wanted to discuss.
Yeah, but before that, man, that was good music. I'm going to get with you after the broadcast. That had a nitty gritty dirt band, Bojangles.
Yeah, I love that guy. His name is Britton Duckworth, and I wish he put out even more music because he has a great voice. And trying to support the bands and the artists. That support
he
the movement.
To be careful because that almost sounded like Mr. Bojangles. Anyway, yeah, you know, and that's I guess that's what we're looking at is being controlled. And there's actually a technology. I was listening to Chris Hinckley that they're trying to come out with the science of actually reading your mind and controlling your thoughts and manipulating you. To basically make you a slave, a zombie, and you'll be a happy camper. You know, there's actually I sent you a link to the pseudoology, the art of lying, a little 30-minute video that's eye opening.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's what they're trying to do. It's almost like hypnotizing you with the cadence of the voice, and they can make you do anything and love it. But they're actually talking about control. You know, I've talked before about augmenting reality. They're talking about not only augmenting it, but creating it at a particular time and place where Darren and John can be watching the same thing happen, but because of their ability to control you, you'll see or hear what you want to hear. Kind of like the holodeck on Star Trek, where you'll be living in this world, a virtual reality augmented to your likings and your tastes. Darren, what better person to have to be a slave than one that thinks that they're living in a condition or a situation that is 180 degrees opposed to what you're actually putting them through?
Well, we're seeing the augmented reality, John, you know, with that. I come back to that reporter shooting, you know, where that reporter was allegedly shot, and we know that was a faked operation because the two different videos didn't match up. But you noticed, and I don't know how you found it, but there is a video game that looks strikingly similar to the very thing that was used in that. This was supposedly supposed to be one of those. What do they call them? GoPros or whatever.
Well, it's a first person shooter game that uses your cell phone camera to destroy and it's like a laser tag game where you destroy people that are not part of the new world.
Right.
You know, they're not involved in that new world, and you got to eliminate them because they're like a virus in a program, and that's what the synopsis of this game said, and it was in beta testing, Darren, looking for crowdfunding and beta testing at the time that this reporter was supposedly killed. So we were watching a beta test, I believe.
Yeah.
But it
certainly did look similar to what they presented on their website. And then my point in bringing that up is you're talking about augmented reality. It's very difficult now knowing what's real and what's not real when you can have an augmented reality scenario just like that. And it be almost indistinguishable from reality, and you have manufactured media events. I don't think every mass shooting is a manufactured media event. I think it's some of them are real, and some of them the media pays attention to. while they don't pay attention to others. But the problem is you can build anything up as and make it seem like it's widespread, happening on a big scale by just reporting a lot on it. And I think that's a lot of what's taking place with these mass shooting events.
Well, if you can tie the book 1984 into our present time and the situation that we find ourselves in, and you look at 1984, one of the last things in the book was this Winston getting his face crushed by the boot, and what did he say? It was something to the effect of slavery is freedom and freedom is slavery or something.
And ignorance is strength.
Effect. Well, you're going to... Yeah, okay. And so we're coming to the winding down of it, I believe, not just because of 1984, but because of everything that we're seeing before us. That book has been playing out. The Bible has been playing out. And we're coming to the point now where we're not going to know reality from fiction and fiction from reality. The Bible says they're exchanging evil for good and good for evil. They're calling bitter sweet, sweet bitter. Where are we at, Darren? We're there right now where things that you and I both know, not because of any other reason than our conscience, if nothing else. You know there's things that shouldn't be done. You don't have to have anyone tell you. It was more profound and apparent when we were children and we were snitching a piece of bubble gum from the store. We felt like we were robbing the bank. Okay, and the longer we live in this world, the more desensitized we become to the difference between right and wrong or good and evil. And so here we are. We're doing things and seeing things now that you don't need anyone to tell you it shouldn't be done, but yet we're doing it. We're turning that box on in the house and we're laughing at it. Collectively as a nation, we're laughing at it when two men are in bed together or two women are in bed together or someone's cheating on their wife, or they're robbing a casino. They're doing things that we know are not proper to do, and we're desensitized, and we're accepting, and if you speak out against it, you're intolerant, you're a hater. You know, so the day is here where good is evil, and evil is good.
Yep.
So how much more time do we have before this just all comes out in the wash, and, and the hares and the weed are sorted out. I mean,
yeah, I don't think it's going to be very long. And, I saw a comment earlier in the chat room. Somebody was saying that, I wish the whole thing would just go ahead and collapse. I'm tired of waiting. The problem with that, of course, is that there's going to be many, many people that are going to suffer. And I think once it does collapse, you're going to see a long scale. I think... past depressions are going to look, I think they're going to pale by comparison. We had the 1930s Great Depression, went on for many, many years. The Long Depression, in the 1890s, that went on for many years. But this is a global situation. And we're really, you've heard the bankers. We played the audio on the show. They're saying that we're in uncharted territory. Not even they. I mean, we give them more power than they really have a lot of times in our minds. Because when people don't understand something, you tend to, in your mind, imagine it to be worse than it really is. I think a lot of times because we don't understand them, we don't understand our enemy entirely. I think a lot of times we make them out to be a lot more powerful than they really are, almost like they're infallible, they plan these things and they have perfect plans and it works in their favor every time. I think a lot of this they're trying to figure out themselves as they go along. And the problem is they're not infallible. I mean, the problem for them, anyway.
What's amazing to me, Darren, is that a truck driver in Tennessee and a TV guy in Michigan
who have no degrees in finance or high finance and no position in a business can see this and have seen this, and other people with sixth grade educations have seen this coming, but yet people with multiple masters of business from multiple colleges, multiple degrees, Ben Bernanke and others, apparently, according to them, either planned it, but they're saying, well, we didn't know that this would happen. Well, you're either lying or you're as dumb as a box of rocks. Or as they say down here, your mama done dropped you on your head one too many times. Because it's pretty clear that when you build with nothing on top of nothing, and you're giving an implied value to something with no value, and you're borrowing and you're building this house of cards to the point where we're, according to some people, quadrillions of dollars in debt, that it cannot go on forever because it's a maxim, out of nothing, nothing comes. So you can't have something when you're building on nothing. You're on a weak foundation, and eventually it's going to collapse under the weight of its own weight.
And then you have people like Janet Yellen being interrogated by Congress. Listen to this.
I want to take a trip down memory lane because I think there's some rewriting of what happened in the crisis. There's a lot of people who bought homes, and for lower income folks, that's their investment. And a lot of them lost their investment walking into the crisis, devastating families. And I know we want to look to Wall Street, and there's blame there. But I think there's a little bit of revisionist history when we say, you know what, Fannie and Freddie didn't have anything to do with the crisis. Fannie and Freddie that allowed no doc loans, no income verification, allowing folks to buy homes they couldn't afford. And in Dodd-Frank, that was passed by my friends across the aisle, Fannie and Freddie weren't touched at all. Fannie and Freddie were the ones that were allowing folks in this room to get homes that they couldn't afford and they were hurt. Didn't touch them. The regulators had wild authority and power. They failed. And instead of taking a look at the regulation and the regulators, we've re-empowered regulators. And so no wonder that big banks after Dodd-Frank haven't gotten smaller. Big banks have gotten bigger. And the small community banks that I'm sure service a lot of the folks in this room and service folks in my community, they're going away. Big problem. I just had to get that off my chest. But a lot of exciting things to chat about you with Chair Yellen. But as the chairman of the Oversight Committee, I do have some concerns about your willingness to comply with our requests. We sent a letter in the Medley investigation and our oversight of the Fed asking you for information in regard to communication. No compliance. Then we sent you a subpoena in May. You did not comply with that.
No, John, in the way of background, let me just say this. You remember when Ben Bernanke sat before one of the oversight committees? They asked him where the money for the TARP program, for all these bailout funds, where it was going, and would he tell them? Would he disclose it? And he just point blank said no. He told...
Well, not only that...
He told him no.
Not only that, but when that senator... what was his name? I can't remember his name. When he asked him, there's $5 billion missing. Where did it go? And the answer was, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, so...
So they thumbed their nose. They completely thumbed their nose at Congress, okay? But he's saying, you know, we can't get you to comply. Now listen to what Yellen says in response to him.
We had partial compliance in October. We're now a year after my initial letter. I've asked you for excerpts of the FOMC transcripts in regard to the discussion in regard to the internal investigation on Medley. You have not provided those to me. Is your intent today now to promise that I will have those, if not this afternoon, tomorrow?
Well, Congressman, I discussed this matter with Chairman Hensarling and indicated that we have some concern.
Well, why don't we talk about it right now?
Providing these transcripts.
Finding the transcripts?
I said with providing transcripts given their importance in monetary policy.
So let me be clear.
And I received a note back from Chairman Hinserling last night, quite late, indicating your response to that, and we will consider it and get back to you.
I don't want you to consider it. And I think the chairman would agree with me that this is a conversation not about monetary policy. This is not market-moving stuff. This is about the investigation and the conversation of a leak inside of your organization. So this institution is entitled to those documents. Would you agree?
I will get back to you answer. I believe that we have provided you relevant information.
If I'm not entitled to it, can you give me the privilege that you're going to exert that's going to let me know why I'm not entitled to those documents?
I said that we received, well after the close of business yesterday, a letter explaining your reasoning.
I will need some time
to discuss this matter with my staff. Give you a final answer.
I sent you a letter a year ago on February 5th. I had to send you a subpoena. You knew that I'm looking for these documents. You knew I was going to ask you about this today. So if you're not going to give me the documents, exert your privilege. Tell me your legal authority why you're not going to provide this to us. If this is market moving, I would be sensitive to that. This is not monetary policy conversations. This is about the internal workings of the Fed. And I'm not asking for all the transcripts. I'm just actually asking for the excerpts specific to our investigation and oversight of the Fed. Let me ask you this. You get to oversee banks. If you make a request to a bank for information a year ago, and they say, let me review with my board, let me talk about it, but they never comply with your request for documents or information, what would the Fed do?
I think we have complied fully with the requests that you've made.
I'm asking you, what would you do if you had made that kind of request to a bank that you oversee? What would you do?
Silence.
We work with banks to make sure we have access to the information.
And if they didn't, I can't imagine what the Fed would do if someone didn't comply with your request. And guess what? We're entitled to the documents. We expect to get them unless you exert a privilege, and there is no privilege that you have. So I expect they'll come over. I yield back.
Time of the gentleman is, for what purpose is the ranking member seeking recognition?
Is it appropriate to ask for unanimous consent for clarification on a point of information that was just given by the gentleman?
Does the lady have a parliamentary inquiry?
The inquiry could be considered parliamentary. I understand the gentleman to say that they subpoenaed the feds and did not, it was ignored. Is that what he meant?
The gentlelady is not stating a parliamentary inquiry, and as I think is the ranking member knows, the time of the chair is limited. If other members wish to pursue that in their questioning, they may pursue it in their questioning. The chair now recognizes the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Hinojosa.
So there you go. What we're talking about here are leaks coming out of the Fed, which influence or determine which direction the markets will go. Okay, because every time they open their mouth, it affects the markets. But what's interesting to me about this whole exchange is the absolute contempt that the Federal Reserve has for the entity that created it. Who's running the government? It certainly isn't Congress. I guess that's the point. What do you think, John?
Well, I think you've nailed it. The answer is that the borrower is slave to the lender. And since we've been borrowing money from the Fed for over 100 years, which is based on nothing, we're in debt to the tune of trillions and quadrillions of dollars. And they're going to tell us what to do.
Yep.
The sad part is that the Congress and the Senate and probably even people, I don't know about people sitting in the cabinet, but very few people really understand what a creature has been created and really where the true battle lies, man. It is all about the money. We've heard it all our lives. Follow the money. We've heard it all our lives. The
the man who pays the piper calls the tune. Well, guess what? The Fed has been paying the piper. They've been giving you money, created out of nothing, charging with interest, knowing that since they created the money, you'll never be able to pay them off because you don't have the money to. You may pay the cap, the principal, but how are you going to pay the debt with the money that they gave you, which is debt? So you're indebted forever, and they know it.
Yep.
And the people in our government are playing the game, and they're many of them know what's going on, and others are just honest, intelligent, well-intentioned people that are flying blind, not knowing that they're even in the real fight. They think they're doing something that's going to mark them down in history, and they're going to leave a legacy, when the fact of the matter is America's goose has been cooked since they put the Fed in. The banks have been running it. The wars have been fought for it. You know, it's been set by, I can't remember the guy's name from World War I. War is a racket. Smedley Butler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, war is a racket. He said in his book he fought wars for the rich people, for the big businesses. And we see it all around us. And everyone's just like, well, I'm living a good life. Got a nice boat, got a nice car, and I know I go there a lot, but that's, the book says, Darren, the love of money is the root of all evil.
And there you go.
And that's what it is. And the money they're loving really isn't even money.
Nope. It's debt. It's debt. And we work all our lives for debt and pay our debts
and you
with debt.
Up, listen, you wind up owing your soul to the company store.
Yeah. And you end up losing your soul to tech tattoos. Man, what a rosy picture we've painted now.
Yeah, and then you listen to what Christine Lagarde said. I think it was last year, the year before, talking about numbers, using esoteric numerology at the World Bank, and then ending her little diatribe on them. We at the World Bank want to be involved in it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all around us, and we're not seeing it. How are we not? How has Ben Bernanke, or this guy that I met in Nashville, Tennessee, by the last name of Avery, that worked for Wachovia Bank as the chief executive officer in charge of investments at Wachovia, the day before Wachovia went bankrupt, I was talking to this guy, and he either didn't know, and I know that he did know, but he couldn't tell me he knew, because then he's violated his fiduciary responsibility, could lose his job.
Yeah.
So they can't tell you the truth by law.
Yep.
And the average American person is ignorant and oblivious without knowledge, and my people perish for lack of knowledge.
Yep.
So it's time we study.
And we're here. That's exactly why we're here, is to increase that knowledge.
That's it.
Yep. Well, John, I appreciate your call, my friend. It's always,
thank you for letting me contribute.
Well, it's always a blessing to have you. And so.
All right.
God bless. We'll talk
soon.
Take care. All right. Bye bye. Well, folks, you're welcome to call in 1-844-646-8376. That's toll free 1-844-646-8376. 1-844-6-GOVERN. Before the break, we were talking, or before the phone call and the break, we were talking about the origins of ISIS. And we've talked about this before on the show, but Ben Swan had a very good piece about this. He has a different kind of take on it, going back a little bit more in depth. So let's hear what he has to say.
ISIS actually began as a small insurgent group in Iraq in 2006. They had no money, no real ability to recruit, but they did work to create very limited problems for the U.S. military. It wasn't until 2009 that ISIS shifted its focus from Iraq, where it was largely unsuccessful in developing a foothold, and focused on the civil war in Syria. Even there, ISIS struggled to gain any foothold, because the two largest groups fighting against President Bashar al-Assad were al-Nusra Front, or al-Qaeda, and the Free Syrian Army. Then came a pivotal moment that most Americans aren't even aware of. In June of 2013, a northern general for the Free Syrian Army spoke out on Al Jazeera Qatar and stated that if international forces did not send weapons, the rebels attempting to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would lose their war in just 1 month. Well, only months before, I had personally confronted President Obama about why the U.S. was covertly funding those Syrian rebels.
And yet there's some concern about the U.S. funding the Syrian opposition when there are a lot of reports that al-Qaeda is kind of heading up that opposition. How do you justify the two?
Well, I share that concern. And so what we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
So even as the president acted as if he was being careful, politicians like Senator John McCain demanded action.
So it's a totally unfair and unbalanced fight. And now the rebels are the freedom fighters. The Syrian National Army are being beaten every place around Syria because of the overwhelming firepower. And air power is really the deciding factor. So you've got to take their air power out of it. You've got to have a safe zone where they can operate, train, and equip. And we've got to turn this thing around.
So what happened? Well, within just a matter of weeks of that Syrian general making his plea for international help, the U.S., the Saudis, Jordan, Qatar, Turkey, and Israel began providing weapons and training and money to the so-called rebel Free Syrian Army. By September of 2013, American media outlets, including CNN and the Washington Post, were reporting that CIA-funded weapons had begun flowing to Syrian rebels. The weapons were not American-made, but funded and organized by the CIA.
Okay, so when we come back, we'll finish this report because I think this is very important, ladies and gentlemen. The information that Ben Swan has brought forward. It's very important for people to understand all of this. We've talked about it a lot on the show, but the average American, the average person, does not have any idea where all this stuff comes from. So when they're threatening you with ISIS, when they're threatening you with terrorism, the reality is they're threatening you with their own tactics, their own machinery. And this is the thing that everyone needs to be aware of. Bottom of the hour break, final half hour of Govern America is straight ahead. Please be with us. Stay with us.
High above the ashes, close by the flag, we're fighting for. And there's a brave new spirit in America, united forevermore.
All right, we're back. This is Govern America. That's Luke Ozana, by the way. Don't tread on us. As we continue on here, finishing up here with this report from Ben Swan, and then we'll get to the caller. So, caller, just hang with us just another moment.
The artillery was described as light weapons, some anti-tank weapons, and ammunition. But where it all fell apart, weapons that the U.S. insisted would be used by freedom fighters would be in less than 1 year in the hands of ISIS fighters. So where were these fighters coming from? Actually, from the Free Syrian Army, the group that John McCain insisted would help the U.S. to overthrow Assad. That same group actually giving weapons, selling weapons, and sending fighters to join with this new group called the Islamic State. It was in June of 2014 when suddenly, after being a no-name group in Syria, that ISIS emerged, heavily armed and trained by U.S. and coalition special forces, making a dramatic entrance by crossing back over the Syrian border into Iraq, capturing Mosul and much of the northern part of the country. One of the most important facts that mainstream media ignores time and time again is that ISIS was able to grow so fast because of all the U.S. military equipment they were able to seize. Equipment that our military left in Iraq. Truckloads of Humvees, tanks, and weaponry that instead of taking or destroying, the U.S. government simply decided to leave behind. Even when the U.S. government knew that ISIS fighters were capturing that equipment, for crying out loud, these guys were posting pictures of themselves driving and standing on U.S. military equipment, making video of themselves with it. We did nothing.
We did nothing. So what does that tell you about this whole war on terror? And what does that tell you when politicians like Ben Carson and others say that we're fighting ISIS? Ladies and gentlemen, we're shadow boxing with ourselves. That's the bottom line. Now, we got further evidence, by the way, that the U.S. ally, quote-unquote, Turkey, which we've been talking about on this show for ages now, is incommunicado with the ISIS terrorists. We'll get to that in a moment, but first I want to take this call. Hello, caller, you're on the air. Who do we have?
Good afternoon, Darren. This is Harvey in Florida.
Hi, Harvey in Florida. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I tune in late. I try to catch you every Saturday. But your show is so informative and so wonderful. You must put in some hours to get this show so perfect and wonderful, so full of information. How do you do it, Darren?
Well, I can tell you with my life, you know, you fit it in wherever you can. Be honest with you, there's a lot of sleepless nights. Generally, Friday nights, I don't get much sleep.
It's really so wonderful because, you know, a lot of times I don't get a chance to catch you, and you provide the service. It could go onto the internet or onto the network, right?
Yeah.
And come up with the whole story, everything you need to know to know what's going on through your show. It's terrific. American Voice Radio you're on, correct?
That is correct. We appreciate Frank Steffen and the folks over there at AVR for doing the job that they do as well. Because they're put us up on the bird. They're very reasonable with the cost that's involved in that, and you know, they're good people, and so it's great to be affiliated with such a good bunch of folks.
Yes, Frank Steffen, he does a wonderful job. He really provides invaluable. I mean, just terrific what you do every week. And I know I send you emails, but I wanted to express it on the air. Just keep it up.
Well, I appreciate
that. You're doing.
It's good to know that we're not alone. You know, I mean, it's good to know that people are out there, and you know, we're all in this really together. Because if America fails, and it's not just the United States, I've heard from people from other countries that said, you know, our eyes are on you. You know, our eyes are all on the United States of America, because if the U.S. goes under, we all go under. You know, that's the perspective from different people around the world that I've heard from, you know, over the years. Everyone is really kind of rooting for us, except for certain people who've had their country destroyed by our military. You know, I guess they're kind of rooting for our demise. But it'll be a sad day, you know, when this thing falls. And I, you know, as we know it, I think it's unavoidable. There's certain aspects of this we're going into, whether we like it or not, and there's really very little that we can do about it except personal preparedness. And, you know, because I think that the banking game, the corporate banks, everything the way it's been established, there's a certain amount of this that is unavoidable. And I think it's very incumbent upon everyone to be prepared to the best of their ability. And I realize that's not easy anymore, as a lot of people have tight funds. Some people have limited space. But people have to do whatever they can, Harvey, because it's coming. It's coming. And when it comes, I think it's going to be hard. Go ahead.
It's coming, all right, because the wrath of God for all the evils that most of the people in this country failed to speak up about. And, I mean, how many millions of people? And just in the last, since 9/11, people have had nothing to do with it. How many people have we slaughtered? 3 million? 2 million? And then you have a lady running for president. I just listened to her again.
Is that what you call her?
Yesterday, just to remind myself. What's that?
I said, is that what you call her, a lady?
Well, she's really the devil. She's really the devil, and she has, I mean, it's incredible that she has the audacity and the nerve to run. She really should be in a war crimes trial. I mean, just her own statement that she made about the war, and when she was asked about it, the way she explained it away, how important it was for regime change. And, you know, this is Mr. Gaddafi in Libya. He gave away all his nuclear weapons on a promise from the CIA and our administration leaders, including Hillary Clinton and the rest of these cretins, that he would give up his nuclear weapons. We flew them to Tennessee, gave up all the nuclear, his ability to really fend us off.
Yep.
And what did we do? We had him slaughtered, and she laughed, and she's laughing.
Yeah.
She invaded the country, her and NATO, and the help of ISIS, which you were just broadcasting about. Of course, we armed and trained all the people.
We came, we saw, he died.
To destroy that country. It's unbelievable. It's so sick. And we're going to have the wrath of God. It may not be today, it may not be tomorrow. But the things that this country is responsible for, our leaders, our supposed leaders. It's so sick and so demented, and we have to speak out. The few of us that actually have a conscience and a caring and a hint of what this world should really be about. So I just wanted to thank you on the air, Darren, because you really do a wonderful job, and you really stimulate my knowledge, and you add to it with all those. And these are clips that you play. You're not making anything up. You don't have to make this up.
It's all documentable.
You couldn't make up.
It's just documented.
You couldn't make this up.
Yeah, well, that, and that's why we do that, is because it's documented.
Everything is documentable.
Yep, exactly. Well, thank you, Harvey. I appreciate that, and your encouragement is very, very much appreciated.
And anybody that can afford to support you, I advise them to go to your website, please. Coalition for Govern America, and please support you, because this is knowledge that you purvey is worth a fortune, my friend.
I appreciate
you so much.
Blessings to you, my friend. Thank you. All right, folks, we're going to move on here in the interest of time here, talking about the ISIS situation. We shared with you from Ben Swan the origins of ISIS, and I said that we had some new information regarding, you know, the ISIS stuff that we played so far has been pretty much foundational, but more information has come out now in regard to how Turkey, the U.S. ally, State Department's working with Turkey. We talked about the Syrian rebels going through Turkey into Greece. And now we have also Brandon Turbeville weighing in, tempting fate and risking both prosecution and shutdown. There's a newspaper in Turkey called the Cumhuriyet. It's recently revealed yet more evidence that Turkey is collaborating directly with ISIS terrorists and assisting them across the border into Syria. So the refugees, as they come across the border, we also have terrorists coming across borders. The Turkish paper, Mr. Turbeville writes, has published new transcripts of telephone conversations between Turkish military officers and ISIS/jihadists fighters. These documents allegedly stem from a court case currently moving through the Turkish judicial system in the Ankara Third High Criminal Court relating to the Islamic State. The investigation apparently began when 6 Turkish citizens reported to law enforcement officials that their family members had joined ISIS. Around 19 people were monitored as a result of, and 27 individuals were charged. The Cumhuriyet, which is, the newspaper, published the first batch of documents in December 2015, which were subsequently reported by the Independent and other alternative media in the West. Now, jumping to this report here, this was December of last year.
Listen to what RT reported.
Military personnel at the Syrian border have allegedly had communications with Islamic State. Those claims have been reported by Turkish opposition media. Artis Mirev Savi has got the latest details on it.
Well, allegedly, Turkish officers on the Syrian border were communicating with Islamic State terrorists on the Syrian side. This is according to the Cumhuriyet Daily, which said that the phones of 19 individuals were tapped in this investigation. Now, according to these reports, the Ankara's chief prosecutor office called for the surveillance on the suspicion that they were communicating with these Islamic State militants. This came to light because relatives of six different Turkish individuals came to authorities saying that they think their relatives went over to the Syrian side, and at that point they decided to tap into the phone wires. Now, one example where a military member is saying to members of the Islamic State within Syria that they are delivering the vehicle and that, quote, materials are on us. This is definitely another on a long list of accusations against individuals within Turkey, including the fact that Turkey is allegedly purchasing oil from the Islamic State in Syria, and a more recent accusation by a Turkish member of Parliament, Eren Erdem, in which he says that chemicals used to make sarin gas passed through Turkey on their way to Syria into the hands of the Islamic State, and there they were building the chemicals themselves. Other allegations against individuals in Turkey is that Turkish hospitals were reportedly treating wounded Syrian terrorists, as well as a German documentary which aired showing that Islamic State was conducting slave trade via a Turkish city near the Syrian border.
Okay, so that, again, that report was in December. Now, these new transcripts, Turberville continues, are supposed to be conversations between Turkish military officers and Mustafa Demir, a leading ISIS figure based near the Syrian-Turkish border. As the Cumhuriyet writes, quote, the transcripts and the documents in the investigation revealed that Demir received money from smugglers at the border and cooperated with the officers as far as border crossings are concerned, unquote. RT provides a sample of some of the interactions between Demir and Turkish military officers. In the first transcript, they say, translated into English, Demir is talking to a Turkish military officer, saying things like, where are you, big brother? At the place where I told you to be? Yeah, we also saw you, your men. It is possible for you to arrange that I talk with the commander here regarding the business here. What if we could establish a contact here as we helped you? Anyway, he goes on and uses different things, you know, different parts of the conversation, which I won't get into. But Turberville says, interestingly enough, Demir also has alleged ties to ISIS military, ISIS leader Ilami Bali, who was connected to bombings inside Ankara in October. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is one of the things that could be confusing to a casual observer. They had the bombings over there in Turkey. We're supposed to believe, I suppose, that Turkey now is the victim of the Islamic State and their terrorist attacks. What I believe the bombings were, and I think there's evidence to spell this out, was a very poorly executed false flag operation so that Turkey could turn around and blame Syria for carrying out these bombings, when in fact, here you see also this Ilami Bali. This is an ISIS leader who this Demir is in contact with, who in turn is in contact with Turkey. So it's a very interesting, tangled web, strange bedfellows. It pretty much tells you who's cooperating with whom. Anyway, this newspaper, the Cumhuriyet, has revealed a number of examples of cooperation between Turkish military and Turkish intelligence agents with ISIS militants. In May 2015, the paper revealed that a Turkish convoy hit by an airstrike in northwestern Syria was carrying weapons to terrorists. Cumhuriyet also reported in December that Turkish officers on the Turkey-Syria border have had contact with ISIS militants and aided in their movements across the border. So, it's very obvious that if the United States government really wanted to stop ISIS, the first thing they should be doing is working on their ally, Turkey, because they are a state-sponsored terrorist entity. But of course, listeners, so is the U.S. State Department. And this is the point about all of this. Now, continuing on, we see from Russia Today, wiretapped call revealed communications between Turkish officers and ISIS. We'll put that in the show notes so you can read that. That's a separate article. And we see also from a website called shadowproof.com, BBC report explains how U.S. and U.K. weapons flow to al-Qaeda and other extremists in Syria. They say Western weapons and equipment flow freely between the so-called moderate, quote-unquote moderate, rebels in Syria and their close allies from extremist groups like al-Qaeda, according to an investigation from a BBC reporter. In a December 17th episode of the BBC radio series, The Report, investigative journalist Peter O'Born, documented disturbing evidence that the United Kingdom and the United States continue to support the Syrian opposition, particularly the Free Syrian Army, despite ample evidence that they work closely with extremist groups NATO has traditionally thought of as enemies. So you... Are you kidding me? We've got the BBC saying what we've been saying on this broadcast for years? The BBC? British government propaganda outlet? Perish the thought, listeners. But apparently that's the case. O'Born reported that at least two Westerners who were accused of aiding extremist groups in the region found their charges rapidly dropped when they argued that seeking to destabilize Syria and depose its president Bashar al-Assad, they'd fought on the same side as the UK. He also explained how the US has aided al-Qaeda's efforts to, quote, rebrand its Syrian branch, the Nusra Front, as a moderate group, able to safely finance and be managed by the US. As O'Born noted, government officials as high-ranking as the vice president have admitted that the United States and al-Qaeda are on the same side, listeners. Well, gee, that's not what George W. Bush told us. Didn't he say that al-Qaeda was the problem? Didn't he say that this is something that needed to be dealt with? Wasn't that the whole reason for the war on terror? Al-Qaeda, we got to track these terrorists everywhere they go. We got to face them abroad so we don't face them at home. How's that working for us, too, by the way? Again, we come back to unanswered questions about the San Bernardino killings. Uh-huh. Apparently, we're facing them at home if we're supposed to believe the San Bernardino story. So I guess that strategy isn't working, huh? And now we have the FBI coming out and saying there could be a third militant, a third shooting. Even as they allowed the media to go in and destroy the crime scene. You remember that? Media was allowed to come into their home, these alleged terrorists, and completely ransack the place. Completely destroy all the evidence. Completely and totally destroy the crime scene. Now, if you think this is real, ladies and gentlemen, answer that one for me. How is it that you have a federal crime scene, an international crime scene, and they allow it to deliberately be destroyed? Well, I guess there could be a shooter. Well, I guess there could be a lot of things. We don't know, because you destroyed the crime scene. Anyway, they say in this piece, to explain how Western military weapons and equipment ended up in the hands of extremist groups in Syria, O'Born invoked the origins of al-Qaeda in the 1989 invasion of Afghanistan by Russia, and the Afghan rebel groups and foreign Mujahideen fighters from Saudi Arabia and Yemen, who were secretly backed by the West. He says, what we saw in Afghanistan 30 years ago was that the West didn't directly arm the extremist groups, some of which were to become al-Qaeda. Alastair Crook, a British diplomat and former intelligence analyst for MI6, the UK's primary foreign intelligence agency, told O'Born, rather than directly supplying weapons to these rebels, Crook explained, they used the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, in other words. and also the Saudi Arabian Intelligence Service. He recalled that when he explained or complained to the U.S. intelligence agents about the natures of their allies, they agreed, retorting, "Well, yes, Alistair, but these groups you're complaining about sure kick communist ass." And that's a direct quote. There's always a boogeyman. Now, do I think communism is a real threat? Yes, I do, to the extent. But now we have the boogeyman being terrorism. Now we have boogeymen being verbs and pronouns and nouns. Terrorism, something you can't nail down, something that has different definitions to different people. This is a never-ending war in the name of peace. And the world is their target. And you, folks, are a part of the world. You are under the gun. Because as long as you can form a coherent thought, as long as you have a soul, as long as you have a conscience, and as long as you can think for yourself, you, my friend, are the enemy. Their enemy. And if you don't think so, how about this? CBSNews.com. U.S. enlists new recruit in fight against ISIS. Who is that recruit? Hollywood, listeners. Hollywood. The United States, they say, is enlisting a new recruit in the fight against ISIS. Hollywood. A photo of Secretary of State John Kerry, Mr. Skull and Bones himself, on his Twitter, showed his meeting in Los Angeles with about a dozen studio executives and Hollywood insiders. Now, why would John Skull and Bones Kerry be meeting with Hollywood? He said in his tweet, "Great convo with studio execs in L.A. Good to hear their perspectives and ideas of how to counter Daesh narrative." Can you say propaganda? Can you say TV shows? Can you say movies? Can you say working all of this stuff in? Who is the enemy? Who is ISIS? When they're filtering all this stuff into your media, the media that you, many Americans anyway, digest. Kerry said he called the meeting to discuss ideas about how to counter what he calls the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria narrative. Report CBS News correspondent Ben Tracy. But some are concerned that he might be recruiting studio executives. Well, you think? He might be recruiting studio executives to help produce anti-ISIS propaganda. Well, how do we know he's not helping produce pro-ISIS propaganda? Who's producing all the beheading videos? And how much of this can we believe, ladies and gentlemen? I don't think very much. They all come from the SITE intelligence group, S-I-T-E. And we know that the person who's ahead of that has very questionable... Well, there's a lot of things questionable about the whole operation. Why is this organization considered an authority for quote-unquote discovering all the video, all the beheading videos with Jihadi John and people in cages being burned alive, which looks like a box office production? There's a lot more close cooperation going on already between the State Department and Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. And this meeting that Kerry had earlier this month, just a couple of weeks ago, with Hollywood, spells that out perfectly. Anyway, moving along. There's a lot of things going on. I said earlier I was going to get to the shootings. We don't really have time for the shootings, but Kalamazoo, Kansas, Alabama. I guess I shouldn't have said there hadn't been a mass shooting lately, last week, because it's almost like they opened up the floodgates. I know it had nothing to do with anything I said. I'm not that important. But they're pulling out all the stops to convince you folks that you need to give up your rights. Spread the word. Everyone needs to be aware of the situation going on in our country, the propaganda that's on every front. We have a German government using Trojan spyware to monitor their citizens. Even as the Homeland Security scale for terror threat is pushed forward into the major mainstream. Homeland Security creating a new breed of terrorism. We're going to have a lot of things added to the show notes that we didn't have a chance to get to today. Genetically modified information for foods. There's a dark act pending in Congress that you need to know about. Going to try to preempt state laws mandating genetic modified labeling. You need to know about it. God bless you, folks. We'll talk to you next week.